Radio is a beautiful medium to work in. I think it's much more fun than the telly. I've been working in radio for just 10 years and I wish I got into it sooner. Last week I interviewed three radio veterans. They're all presenters of programs on our sister network, Radio National. Fran Kelly, host of the Weekday Breakfast program, Robin Williams, the long-standing presenter of The Science Show, and Philip Adams himself from Late Night Live. Someone in the organisation had brought out a pocket calculator, totted up the numbers and realised that together, Robin, Fran and Philip have notched up 75 years of broadcasting. So we thought we'd bundle all three of them into a room with a live audience and ask them some impertinent questions for a change. These are seriously dedicated people. One gets up at the most unholy hour every day. The other two have just survived the exact same life-threatening illness and kept working throughout the whole ordeal. We recorded this event last week in that fabulously wonky new Frank Gehry building at the University of Technology in Sydney. And I started with Fran Kelly. Fran is a unique radio broadcaster insofar as her show is simply known as Fran, as in, did you hear the Prime Minister on Fran this morning?
I did breakfast radio for a week and I'm not joking, it nearly killed me. Can you just please explain your routine of a morning?
Well, first I'd like to say that breakfast years are like dog years, so I'm actually celebrating 70 years right now. I get up at 3:30. The secret, I think, to lasting in breakfast radio is routine, absolute routine. So I get up and have a shower and iron some clothes and then I meditate every morning.
You meditate?
Yes, for 15 minutes every morning.
And what's the purpose of that?
Well, when I started doing breakfast radio, I didn't meditate. I knew nothing of it, but if any of you do listen to breakfast, you'll know there's a lot of stories in every single day. And every night I have to prepare for those stories. So I'm reading things about them and backgrounding them that my fabulous breakfast team producers have prepped. So I'd go to bed with all these stories in my head and I couldn't sleep. And, you know, that was a bit of a problem because I had to get up at 3:30. Someone, perchance, a year into the job said you should try meditation. So I learnt meditation and it absolutely did the trick. So something happened in your brain with meditation, all of you who meditate would know, and all the bits sort of get put away in their compartments so you don't worry about them all in this jumbled mess. And it just gave me greater clarity and gave me greater peace of mind and I could sleep and I could perform better on the radio in the next morning. So
do you have some underlying principles you try and bring to your program?
Not that I have written down. But I suppose the values I try and bring, apart from the obvious ones, like we like to be sort of on the news and setting the agenda, is to really bring the listener to mind and to bear in every interview that we do, so that I'm there to represent not just me and the breakfast team, but everyone who's listening to make sure the questions they want known and asked are asked. So truth and the Australian way is what we represent. The big thing, I think, is to know that it is about the news. It's also about including the audience and engaging the audience. And I think the sort of the golden rule is if you start to feel jaded, then that's a problem.
I think there's a challenge for ABC presenters is when you're interviewing a politician and they lie to you, halfway through the interview they'll say something that you know is not true and you're pretty sure that they know is not true. It's not true either. What you say then is obviously very, very important. What happens to you when you hear that, Fran, and what do you do?
It's a constant conundrum. I think I'm actually getting better at it because a lot of the time, for many years, I thought the audience is so smart, they know that person's just spinning a line or telling a lie because of what's gone on or because of what's around it, and I would often move on. These days, I'm much more inclined to say, but Minister, that's not true, or everybody listening knows that the fact is blah. Or, with respect, Minister, which now they're onto and they keep saying it back to me, which is pretty funny. I kind of like that. So I try to engage with it much more directly now. And I often do bring the audience to bear because then it's a less aggressive thing. One thing I'm pretty sure the audience mostly doesn't like is the technique of sort of re-asking the question three or four times till you get the answer. I've only got, on average, 6 or 7 minutes per interview. If you keep doing that, you're not going to get very far in the information game, which I think is what we're all there for. You know, it's a balance every single day in every single interview, and I probably haven't got it sorted yet.
Because the danger with that is that the politician might then drag you into a kind of a nitpicky argument.
A semantic game. Yes. Do I need to name the minister? Yes, I will. The Environment Minister, Greg Hunt, who was the Australia's national debating champion, is just so excellent at sort of getting down a tunnel on a particular point, and it's really a road to nowhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to make the decision all the time, but you are there to keep the bastards honest. That is part of your job. So some days I can hear the roar coming back to me from kitchens all around the country. You didn't ask and you let him get away with it. And, you know, so some days I disappoint myself.
Yeah, but you really just don't want to let those people down in the kitchen, though. Truly, you don't, do you?
You don't.
No, you really don't.
Yeah.
Because you just would hate yourself if you didn't do the right thing by them. I know you feel that responsibility.
Oh, absolutely. That's my job.
Yeah. There's a thing that at the moment a lot of journalists will complain that today's Australian politicians are too vanilla. They all operate off talking points. But, of course, those talking points are given to them by former journalists. And in an environment where journalists are often obsessed with consistency, so when a politician says something interesting, they'll go, aha, you say that, but 6 months ago, I know your leader said this. What do you think about that, Fran?
I think sometimes it's worth doing. Well, I mean, look, it's gotcha journalism, right? And a lot of people do it and do it very successfully. I don't particularly do it, but there are times when, you know, someone has completely contradicted a position they held dearly, and you either need to pick them up on it and say, but hang on, when it suited you said that, or you need to say, what's changed your mind, or else the audience is going, but hang on, 6 months ago they said that, Fran, why aren't you drawing them in? So, you know, you need to do some of it. But I do actually think, I know this is very convenient for the new Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, at the moment, and he's putting it out there because it suits him as well. I do think, though, that the nation is not really interested at the moment in a whole lot of obsession on backflips and backdowns. The fact is, he signalled quite clearly he's going to move away from some of the Abbott government's policies. Most of the country wants him to move away from some of those policies. I don't think we should get caught up in, oh, that's a backflip, you know, which is a sign of weakness. That's a code for, you know, it's a back down, a weakness. On some of these points, where we all know that these are policies that need to be moved away from, then we should just accept that and go, the government's moving on from this and changing this and this is why, rather than get too caught up in the, but you were in that cabinet, you know.
Do you think the tone has improved since Turnbull's become Prime Minister? I mean, since particularly after the Gillard years and the Abbott years, where often they were defensive, they had talking points that they'd go back to again and again. I couldn't help but notice the tone of questions or the quality of questions to them dropped correspondingly. And I'm wondering if you think the quality of questions to the Prime Minister have improved, or if you've noticed a change in tone from interviewing members of the cabinet or the opposition.
Oh, there's definitely a change in tone. I mean, I find ministers much more open since the change of government. And I suppose in terms of the level of questioning, when the position coming from this way is defensive, you need to sort of break through it. And sometimes that takes a certain, you know, lowest common denominator question or a level of aggression or even rudeness. And I think the audience doesn't like that, is sick of that to some degree. And it wasn't getting us anywhere. I think the signal has come from the new Prime Minister that he is a bit more open. He's trying to put his imprint on what kind of interviews we'll do. I mean, it is a bit rich when he picks you up and say, well, Fran, that's old. That's old paradigm. You know, you shouldn't be asking questions like that anymore. It's like, hang on. And he does that, and he does it very well, and I'm sure the audience is loving it at the moment, but it will wear thin, especially with us.
He's a former journalist, and he will sometimes say, well, you know, I was a journalist once myself, and
I know
think I would have
what
asked
you're
a
doing,
better question.
Michael.
And, yes.
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 You know, there is a change of tone, that is for sure. He's signalled it. He says he wants to have a more open conversation. He is more open at the moment, but it is a honeymoon and things will probably change a bit around certain issues and certain questions as time goes on. But I think at this moment, there certainly does seem to be, I'm feeling anyway, a change of response from the front bench in their tone in responding to certainly me as an interviewer.
There are issues you care about. You're only human. There are issues I care about. With those issues, do you talk about them or do you recuse yourself from discussion of them on the radio, the ones you really deeply care about?
Oh, no. I decided a long time ago, actually, that we are ABC journalists and we are meant to be objective, and I think we all try really hard to do that, to be balanced. But balance doesn't mean that you write yourself out of the picture, I don't think. I mean, you are a human, you have values and you should stand by them and represent them. And I decided, actually, it was at the point of the Mabo debate that I was going to sort of stand up for what I thought was clearly and obviously the right position there, which is to, you know, back up the High Court, basically, and do something about it. So I made no bones of that, and made no bones of the fact that I thought Australia needed to apologise very early on in that debate. That's the one issue where I really put it out there early. But that didn't mean that I didn't do balanced reporting, I don't think. I made sure all views were canvassed in the debate constantly, but it meant a commitment to the coverage of the issue. And, I mean, there are issues I care about, and I make sure we cover them on the radio, because I think if I care about them, others do. But it is 3 hours of radio, so we do get to cover a fair range of things every
now,
day.
Now, I know your mum and dad were very, very proud of you and what you do, and your mum certainly was into your show, but your dad perhaps wasn't. Tell me how your mum used to draw your father's attention to when you were on the radio.
Well, my dad certainly was. In fact, later years when it was just Dad, he'd say... every time I'd go back to Adelaide, I'd retune the radio to my station thinking he'd muddle up. And finally, one day, he said... Franny, I'm really not that interested in what you talk about. Which was, you know, endearing and character-forming. But Mum, on the other hand, she was very into it and very, very proud of me, but also just very into issues, and she was a very engaged person. And Dad was deaf, and Dad would be out the back of the shed, and Mum had this big cowbell, and she'd ring the cowbell, and Franny's on the radio, Frank. That's cute.
Now, I know you're a very committed journalist, but deep down... scratching much deeper there, underneath all of that, you are a serious, driven, hardcore, black-jeaned rock chick. Correct?
That's true.
True?
Correct.
This is true. So if, for instance...
If only.
Just this is purely hypothetical. If, for instance, the Divinyls came to you and said, we want you to replace Chrissy Amphlett...
This is a shout-out on national radio.
This is just... Look, I'm just putting it out there. Just putting it out there. Do you quit the day job and take up that gig?
Yes.
You do? You can come back to radio after a while with one of those rock and roll voices. You go, g'day, I'm Frank Kelly.
No, then I get to come back, you know, to WSFM or something.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Franny and the Animal or something on Brekkie Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, thank Fran Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Conversations with Curious Minds, a special event held at UTS in Sydney with three legendary ABC radio broadcasters. Fran Kelly from RN Breakfast, Robin Williams from The Science Show, and Philip Adams from Late Night Live. Philip came to radio after all kinds of different lives, as a film producer, an advertising creative, and a columnist. Philip thought he'd be kicked out after just a year, but he's now been at the microphone of his little wireless program, as he calls it, for 25 years.
Film production, advertising, columnist, radio. Why radio? How did radio start for you, Philip?
By accident. I got a phone call from 3AW, this is 40 years ago, who were trying out people. I only had 7 or 8 jobs at the time, so I thought I'd give it a run. I accidentally invented shock jockery. This is a public... I've never made this confession publicly. I'm sitting there in the studio, and I'm getting friends to come in. Graham Kennedy had been off air over a certain crow noise he'd made. He'd been banished. Graham came in and he turned the microphone off and screamed hatred at the people that were calling in. He was a very tormented fellow. Another bloke that came in was an old friend of mine, Alan Marshall, who many of the older listeners will remember is probably Australia's most beloved writer. I Can Jump Puddles, for example. And Alan... was terribly abbreviated from surgery, and he was wheeled in the wheelchair, sitting on a whole pile of cushions, very old guy. And he was unhappy because Frank Cheshire, his lifelong publisher, who'd made a fortune out of Alan, refused to publish his last book, his last autobiography. Why? Because in it, Alan raised the issue of sexuality and disability. And he's sitting there and he's saying that I think sex workers should go around to disabled people and give us some relief. And I said, I know what we should call the service, Feels on Wheels. Now, when I came off air, the manager of 3AW was standing there with an implacable sort of Easter Island Malcolm Fraser face. And he said, we've just had 600 phone calls of complaint. And I said, oh, shit, I'm sorry. And then his face was wreathed in smiles. He says, it's bloody wonderful. And then I realised the secret of radio is to be abusive. And I like to bitterly complain that I'm not allowed to do it at RN.
What do you genuinely love about the medium of radio specifically?
Well, I invented Gladys. In the beginning, management hated it because it seemed to suggest that the ratings were particularly low, that we only had one listener. But I invented Gladys because that's the secret of the medium. It isn't broadcast. It's incredibly intimate. It's really a conversation between you and a guest and the listener. It's that direct. And I just find that having that in mind, that sense of being in a very close relationship that you don't have on television. You really don't. You don't have it as a columnist and all the other media that I've investigated. You don't have it. But in radio, that is its essence and that is its secret. And you know that because of all the interviews, I hate being interviewed, but the only one I ever enjoyed was yours because you understand this intimacy. You're not threatening. You're congenial. You're conversational in the best sense. That's the essence, I think, of radio. Fran can't do that. She's got to get stuck into people. And good on her. Incidentally, Fran, I did breakfast for a year at TUE, preceding Alan Jones. And it's not going back to dog years, it's an infinity.
It's an infinity.
What you've
yes.
done. And I'm amazed that you're still alive, basically.
I've heard the audio of your very first episode of Late Night Live, where you had a debate with Gerard Henderson, David Hill, the former managing director of the ABC, and Sam Lipsky, I think, where you had the discussion about ABC bias, and interestingly, Gerard Henderson had a view on that.
Well, you'll have to tell me. I can't remember. I'm in shock that I ever spoke to Gerard Henderson. My pacemaker has just gone all funny. Now, Gerard and I used to be friends, for God's sake, once. God, the world has changed.
It has. How do you prepare for an interview?
My producers will tell you and complain bitterly amongst themselves that I don't. I rather like not to know who's on, and I'd rather like not to know too much about the subject, unlike you, Fred, because it's not my job to know. It's my job to learn. And I like the program to sort of be spontaneous as far as is possible. Now, if I'm bored with the guest and if I know nothing about the subject and there's a raft of subjects that I know less than nothing about, then I will follow the pre-prepared and beautifully prepared prompts from the producers. But I find that at its best, radio just goes off on every zigzag direction. So it's not knowing to me, which is the joy of radio. You can get away with it.
I was in comedy for many years, and after a bit of reflection not so long ago, I realised that every comedian I've ever known was an introvert. And I think it's the same as true as for broadcasters too. I think every broadcaster I've known is actually introverted. They need alone time, and I think broadcasting, like comedy, gives them a kind of a licence to ask impertinent questions. What do you think of that?
Well,
I'm the one who wants to be a rock chick, so I don't think that. I think I just disproved your theory.
No, it doesn't. No, no. A rock. That's like channeling all your social energy into an hour, but then you need time alone after that. Rather than having people around you all the time, you need alone time, time to reflect and time to be away from people.
You talked about the job destroying your social life. I have the great advantage I never had a social life. I had no friends. I said, it's funny, no, it's true. I sort of know everybody because of the job. It doesn't mean you've got a lot of friends. I never go anywhere. I never accept invitations. I haven't been to a party for 40 years. It's true.
He doesn't want to go.
And I spend a vast amount of time alone. I grew up on a farm. I've lived on a farm for the last 30 years. Vast vistas of emptiness apart from the odd marsupial. And I spent an awful lot of time driving up between Sydney and the bush, 4 or 5 hours, listening to recorded novels. So, yes, I spend a huge amount of time alive. And the thing that frightens me is being in a conversation with a single person socially. I've got no small talk. Jana Vent and I once thought it came up with a wonderful invention, which was to have auto cue in your glasses. And in your pocket, you'd have this little gadget and you'd press it, weather, football, enough on your glasses would scroll, you know, things you could usefully say about them. I still think it's a great idea.
They can do that now, you know,
and I know you've got them.
Oh, just hang on, I'll just tweak them now. There we go. What do you do with guests who are a bit too smooth, who are giving you stuff they've rehearsed and said many times?
The irony is, if you've got a guest like that, and Gore Vidal is a classic case, or even Christopher Hitchens, you know they can talk under wet cement. Christopher could come on the program. He was absolutely drunk as a skunk, but he could still be absolutely lucid. Gore Vidal was in the same category. So basically, at 10:05, you could introduce him. Then you could go for a walk around the block. You could go up to McDonald's and get a coffee. You could have a smoke. And then you'd just come back and say, thank you, Gore. And you'd get these wonderful letters saying that was one of the best interviews I ever heard. You're irrelevant. But conversely, the interviews I most vividly recall were silent radio. It wasn't the loquacious, it was the non-responsive guest. And I had two of them. One of them was Julie Covington. Julie came to fame, you might recall, singing at the Don't Cry For Me Argentina. She wasn't in the show, but she made a hit of the song. She'd been in my beautiful David Attenborough nature study film, The Adventures of Barry McKenzie. And when I heard she was coming to Australia to do Evita, I invited her on. You know, we were sort of friends. She arrived rigid with anger and tension about something, and she just sat there. And for 20 minutes, she wouldn't answer a question. No matter what I said, her eyes would scroll up and she'd study a light bulb. They'd go down to the floor and look at a bit of chewing gum embedded in the carpet. This went on for 20 minutes. It was hell. I'm told that it was hilarious if you happen to be listening in. But for me, it was just bloody awful. And finally, she just flounced out. And she kept flouncing. She flounced straight to the airport, climbed on the plane, flew back to England, and did not appear in Evita. The other one like that was even worse than trying to interview Marcel Marceau on radio. I was promised that I was going to have a dazzling guest, a very, very important Buddhist monk. Now, as you know, Buddhist monks around the world have often led insurrections in Vietnam, in Tibet, and certainly in Myanmar. The monks of Myanmar were being incredibly brave and being treated quite brutally, and I was to interview the head honcho monk. I said, is his English good? Perfect. So he shimmered into the studio, and he was radiant with goodness and virtue. I can't begin to tell you. There were halos and auras around him. And he was beatific, and he had the robes on, he had lovely dangly things around his neck, and you were sitting there with transcendental holiness. Meditation? I was sitting with a great meditator. I was levitating in the presence. So he's sitting there, and I start to talk to him, and he just smiles. And he kept smiling, and I'd ask him, and he'd keep smiling. And then I realised that not only did he not speak English, he didn't understand English. And like the Julie Covington, this went on for 20 minutes. And I haven't really been at Late Night Live 25 years. It just feels like that.
This has only happened to me twice, I think. And I'm wondering if you've had this experience where you're getting into an interview and about some point during the course of the interview, you get this flash of insight and you go, oh, my God, I'm talking to a total prick.
Have you had that? Getting that now, are you?
No.
Please don't get that now.
Have you had that experience? I don't need you to name names, but you're certainly welcome.
Happy to name names.
Okay.
Who was that English lord who did time and then he became...
Geoffrey Archer.
Geoffrey Archer. The biggest prick I've ever had on in radio. So he comes in. He's briefed himself. He knows that you're a lefty. So he comes in like an army of right-wing maniacs and the venom that just poured out of him. So it wasn't a dawning realisation. It was a just confrontation. And that was another 20 minutes in which I don't think I got a word in edgewise. Well, it was just abusive. I'm never getting him back again.
Do you ever plan to retire?
The only thing that John Howard and I ever agreed on was that retirement is a very bad idea. Now, John and I were born within minutes of each other in 1939. I don't know what that says for astrology. And and we passionately disagree about everything. But when he made it clear that he wasn't going to go unless they dragged him kicking and struggling, which, of course, the Australian public finally did, I felt for him. I felt this fellow feeling. I want to die on air. I want to pass out while Elena Katz-Chernin's ethereal theme is playing. I want to come on and just sort of say, welcome to the little wireless program, Gladys and Bo. And just topple on the desk. And then I want to be stuffed and put in the foyer at the ABC.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
Robin Williams began at the ABC way back in 1972, in the age of the moon landings. He signed up for the science show in 1975 and hasn't looked back. Robin has written 10 books. He survived cancer. He has died 3 times and been resurrected from the dead. And yet the man is still a skeptic when it comes to religion.
Your biography, Robin, says that you appeared in The Goodies and in Monty Python's Flying Circus, but it also says, quote, that you stood in for Tom Jones for 4 months. What on earth does that mean?
I wondered at the time. There was a long series with every star you've almost ever heard of, including The Who and Peter Sellers and any number. And for 2 nights a week, Saturday and Sunday, we did the same show, except we had variation because it was being broadcast in America as well. And so we had to have a different comedian for the Brits from the Americans because the Americans didn't understand British humour at the time. And also you had to have different dancers dressed in a different way because you couldn't show navels then on American television. So they went to this vast expense of doing it twice. So there were lots of rehearsals. And when Tom, for reasons I never understood, was called to the caravan with one of the dancers, I had to pick up his script and walk through for the lighting and the rehearsal. And when I wasn't doing that, I was sitting in the audience and writing an essay on phloem and xylem in botany, which everyone found very puzzling. And then on the night, I perhaps, if Tom was singing Set 'Em Up Joe, I was Joe, polishing the glass behind the bar.
Oh, I hope someone can track down that video and put it on YouTube. You started the ABC in 1975. What do you remember of the ABC in that time?
It's actually 72. I did the science show in 75. Well, it was a bit of a fluke because I walked in off the street asking for a job. I went to see Humphrey Fisher, who is the son of the Archbishop of Canterbury who crowned the Queen, Geoffrey Fisher. And so I knew I could ponce around pretending I'd been to private schools and name drop like crazy. And he said, how much experience have you had? And so I blah, 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 talked about Tom Jones or something, and he wasn't impressed. But he found me so objectionable that he sent me across the harbour to his greatest enemy in radio, Peter Pockley. And by a wonderful coincidence, Pockley had lost 2 of his producers the week before. And we had something really extraordinary coming up fairly shortly. That was February 1972. In May, there was Apollo 16. And in December, there was Apollo 17, which turned out to be the last one. And he wanted me to research all sorts of things like that. So I was appointed. I was on a part-time freelance thing. And so I worked like crazy. Everyone else went to lunch.
You remember your first episode of The Science Show and what you talked about?
I do. Yes, because I was reminded when I was being interviewed on actually local radio, and they played me a bit. The first item was about nuclear weapons and the arms race, and we were being warned at that time by William Epstein from the United Nations about the fact that terrorists might go for mini nuclear weapons and how dangerous this was and how we had to cut back. The second item was about the problem with extinction, animal extinction, And, of course, the record that Australia's got, especially with mammals, is rather dire. And the third one was, and the one that really I found startling, was with Lord Richie Calder, who was a member of the House of Lords, an expert on energy. And he warned about the fact that climate change was probably going to be affected by all this burning of fossil fuels. And he gave the figures, the tonnages of fossil fuels being burned and how much they had been concerned about it since 1963. And here we are in 1975 and no one's done anything about it yet. Yeah. It's astounding.
He was saying, here we are in 1975 and we haven't had action on climate change.
Yeah.
That is quite remarkable. Do you feel in some ways you're talking about the same issues and just watching them get worse and worse over 40 years?
Oh, I know. Here comes innovation again. Here comes the concern about the future and, oh, the same interviews. How do we get kids back into school to do engineering and science and maths? And we've been going around in circles, and if only someone would take it seriously and get it done. The wonderful thing about what we have to do as science journalists is look at the evidence and represent it. It's quite straightforward. And theoretically, unless they're being a bit naughty, they're in pursuit of something called the truth. And so you look around the world for the best way to do innovation, say in Israel, where they invest a lot of money in it and teach entrepreneurship and put business people in the same bed as scientists and people who are doing the creative work. And you get results. You get some of the greatest numbers of startups in the world. So the evidence is there how to excite kids in primary school with science.
I think just about every kid is interested in science in primary school, and we sort of get it knocked out of us in high school. Well, some of us do. I certainly did along the way. And then you come back to it. You feel you have to come back. Are they mainly the people you're broadcasting to? I sometimes feel you're trying to re-engage us with our natural and beautiful childlike curiosity about science, Robin.
Yeah, we're trying to broadcast to everybody because everybody finds it fun if you tell the right stories. And what we try to do, and they do that on Catalyst as well, and that is have the emotion as well as the fact. What Brian Cox is doing with the wonders of science, and Attenborough in his wonderfully intimate but direct way, is talking about the emotion of looking at nature sparkling and being so intriguing. And that goes for everybody.
Do you remember a moment in your childhood when you discovered science?
It was somewhat the other way round. My father was an engineer, mining engineer in South Wales, all the cliches. He was left wing and played rugby and was a tenor, spoke Welsh. But he was a genius at doing all these sums, at doing the sorts of things that I found rather difficult at school. And my father seemed to be saying to me that I wouldn't cope with it because I wasn't like him. But someone telling you you can't do it in almost a sentence made you almost give up. And it's just that I went sideways round selecting those subjects which he didn't do that got me over the line. I suppose in the beginning I read books like Dr. Doolittle by Hugh Lofting, where you speak to the animals. I loved that idea. And because I was growing up in Austria, there was Conrad Lorenz writing about man and dog and those wonderful relationships. How do these animals relate to us? What is there in common? Why do we always want to be with them? So many different sorts of animals, not just cats and dogs and birds. And that intrigued me, and I've been following it up ever since.
In recent years, both you and Philip have been suffering from very unpleasant cancer, and you've both recovered. You're both here. What's going on there? At the same time, the same thing?
I do everything that Philip does, yeah.
Like Philip, though, you kept working almost right through your illness. Why? Yeah, why keep working through your illness?
Well, people kept on talking about that, and I said, you're quite right about needing solitude, but you also need mental stimulation in our job. And all I wanted was 2 hours a day. And we had plenty of material because we go out and collect material, and there it was. And I didn't want to waste it. And so I would, when my voice went completely, as Phillips did at one stage, I would write the script in the hospital bed and send it by email to David Fisher, who would then read the script and we'd put on the material. And one occasion, which I thought was rather delicious, the editor-in-chief of the journal Nature. Now, that's a big deal. That's really the most famous journal in the world. And Sir Philip Campbell was in town, and I said, would he mind coming to the hospital? And he did. And he sat down on my bed, and we recorded an interview, and it was on the following week.
Richard, he will be broadcasting after death.
Posthumously. Well, in some ways we already are.
I'm glad you said that.
Chemotherapy has nasty side effects. Vertigo, nausea, all those things. You've both been broadcasting through the symptoms of chemotherapy?
Yeah, I died. I've died twice. Norman Swan saved me in 1988.
How did that happen?
Well, I think my electrolytes were depleted. In other words, I was running a lot and sweating a lot, and someone had put me on high blood pressure tablets, which make you excrete your electrolytes as well. And if they get to a certain level, you get terribly dehydrated and you fall over. And so I fell over three times in 1988. And in the middle one, Norman woke me up by jumping on my chest. He's been doing it ever since.
You had a cardiac arrest?
I had three cardiac arrests, yes.
Three cardiac arrests, and Norman Swan revived you and brought you back from the dead?
That's right, yeah. I was flatlining for 47 seconds, and earlier this year I did almost the same thing down the south coast when Jonica Newby, my partner, jumped on my chest and did the same thing.
Norman Swan saved my life too, and I'd like to publicly thank him. He did this by getting me from 2UE to RN.
Like I said, though, broadcasting through the side effects of chemotherapy, that must have been strange and disorienting and all those things.
You feel very weak. I didn't get chemo brain, which is supposed to exist where you forget things badly. I had to prepare nouns. It's nouns and names that go. So you write them down. So when they come up, you know they're there. So slight vocabulary loss. But also much more emotional. And I'd be listening to music quite often in tears, floods of tears. Yeah, those drugs do things to you.
How about you, Philip? Were you broadcasting through chemo?
I didn't do chemo. I had so many other fatal diseases. It's true. I had enough Damoclean swords for a dinner service. And so I couldn't be chemoed. But my hair fell out before I got cancer, so I had the side effects.
All of us as broadcasters, I'm struck by the fact we'd all done things, different things, before we came to radio. Is that an important thing for you, Fran?
Yeah, I think it's really important. There's not a day in my job every morning that I don't call on some part of my life outside what I've, you know, read or learnt or thought about for the subject. So I think it's really important, the more life you have behind that you bring with you to the radio every day, you're going to be reflecting a broader range of people and ideas.
Yourself, Philip, I can always hear the huge experience you've had in many different parts of life in Australia that you bring to your role as a broadcaster. In a way, do you think radio, this is the thing that brings everything you've done together in some ways?
Look, we are so bloody privileged. The three of us sitting here, we are so lucky to be working not only in radio, which is an interesting medium, but at the one place which actually encourages ideas. We know it's not a binary world. Issues aren't yes or no. They're infinitely complex. And we have the great joy, privilege of working in that context.
Yeah. We're testing what we do, but experimenting all the time, trying new approaches and listening to what people outside are thinking about and talking about and putting them on as well.
Radio is the career you have after you've had a career, except for Fran. You know, Fran's young. But it's a sort of God's waiting room for the likes of us.
I'm not sure I quite see it that way, but
I think it is important to have a life before you come into an organisation like the ABC, because the ABC is a wonderful, wonderful place to work. And I've been, you know, really lucky and really privileged to have had like a lot of different lives in the ABC. I lived in London for a while and Canberra, and that's, you know, fantastic. And it's a big enough organisation to be able to do that. But it is one cultural institution and you can spend a lot of time there. So I think it's really important. You've been in other places, in other situations and just other cultures and groupings to know that there is another way of being.
That was our reaction to being in hospital so much with cancer, wasn't it? A sense of gratitude, really.
About 4 years ago, I went to the United States to meet program makers of NPR shows like This American Life and The Moth and Radiolab. Interestingly, speaking to them all separately, individually, they all said at one point the same thing. A large part of the value they saw in what they did was to do something underneath America's incredibly boring culture wars. To do something which connects people with the lives of other people they would never otherwise meet.
Well, we bring people into our lives that we wouldn't normally meet,
yes. Exactly.
Which is half the excitement. Look, the great, I joked about guests, but the really interesting guests have never been on radio before, they've never done an interview, they probably never will again, but they come on because they've got an idea or they've invented something or they've written something. And that's the magic of it.
Mm.
And that connects. Very often the most popular guests aren't the famous, they aren't the megastars. They're almost anonymous people that everyone can identify with.
I find exactly the same thing. Do you feel a special duty of care when you have people on like that?
Absolutely.
With people who aren't media savvy at all.
Yeah.
They just have their own story to tell.
And I love that part of what I get to do is that when people, as Philip says, who have something to offer, like they've done something, that's why they're there, they've thought something, they've created something, or they're saying something brave, but they're scared, they're really scared often. And it's an important part of your job to be able to make them feel easy so they're just talking to you. I mean, that's the magic that Philip was talking about, they're just talking to you.
There's a parallel in a strange way in the honours system. The really interesting gong is the lowest order, the OAM. That's the people who work in communities doing the most extraordinary things as volunteers, and they get this little gong. It's nothing like as auspicious as an AM or an AO or an AC, but I've been to some of these ceremonies, and that is so moving for these people to be honoured in that way, and at its best, radio honours them as well.
It does indeed, and in the beginning, way back in 1972, even before the Science Show, when we used to cut up pink tape with razor blades and stick it together again. The people said, I can't be on your program because you broadcast people who never say And I said, I've got a bucket full of ums on the floor. I cut them out all the time.
That'll be the name of your next memoir, a bucket full of ums. I'd like to finish up by just offering a quote here by Jay Allison, who's kind of like the godfather of radio in the United States, the public radio, which brings in the lives of everyday people, the kind of people we were just speaking about who aren't famous, who nonetheless have seen and done interesting and amazing things. Radio gets inside us. Lacking ear lids, we are defenceless, vulnerable to ambush. Sounds and voices surprise us from within. As radio makers, we have this tactical advantage over our colleagues in print, film, television, photography. Our tool is oral story, the most primitive and powerful. Invisibility is our friend. Prejudice is suspended while the listener is blind, only listening. Now, I don't know about you, but sometimes I make up my mind about what kind of a person I'm watching on TV pretty quickly, too quickly. Radio, you can suspend that. Do you notice that about it? The fact you can suspend the prejudice of the listener about the kind of person you're talking to, the background they're from.
Well, not only is that a remarkable truth, but it even extends beyond journalism to drama. The great thing about radio drama, all but missing now, is that you had to think of the sets. You had to design the costumes. You had to imagine the faces. Television pre-imagines.
Mm, absolutely. Last Sunday, I was listening to the radio thinking I had to go out and do something, and it was a woman talking about looking out the window and seeing someone else's bedroom. And she described that for 25 minutes. And I couldn't move. It was so intimate and it was so personal, beyond belief, that you felt as if you'd been with someone real. And then you carried on your life. that doesn't quite happen on television, really.
Can you email me that quote, please, Richard?
I'm very happy to do so.
Bloody great quote.
And it is a great quote, isn't it? And I think it is, intimacy is the word, and Philip and Robin both talked about that. And emotion, too. You can just, there's a different kind of emotion that people are happy to let occur when there's just two of you in a conversation, and it, when it's working really well, you know that they're thinking they're just in that moment with you, and you are in just that moment with them. And it's that emotion, I think, that can carry through the transistor that is really powerful.
It's been such a pleasure speaking to the three of you. Fran Kelly, Philip Adams and Robin Williams, ladies and gentlemen.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on air, online, and on digital radio. You can subscribe totally free to Conversations podcast. Details on the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.